After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. I'm John Manuel, along with Ted Cahill, remotely from Texas, and along with Mike Lanana, remotely from across the table from me, with a phone that is quieter than mine. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Our podcast and all of our college coverage, of course, is sponsored by Louisville Slugger. Visit them on Instagram or on Twitter, at Slugger Nation. And remember that there's power in numbers. Thanks to Louisville Slugger, again, for sponsoring us this year on the podcast. And guys, you know, Teddy, you're down in the Lone Star State. You started off, I believe, with some American Athletic Conference action, but you also have seen some Southeastern Conference action. That's where we wanted to start in regards to this week's college podcast, because we still don't get any separation in the SEC, but we had last week we had LSU as the top-ranked team in the league. They lose a series. Now we have Auburn as the top-ranked team in the league. And I don't think any of us had that as a possibility coming into the year, that Auburn would be vying for the best spot in the AC, in the Southeastern Conference. And especially, we didn't think that it would happen with Keegan Thompson missing some time, or Mize missing some time. They haven't even always been at full strength, Teddy. But why don't you and Mike elaborate for our readers and our listeners, how the hell did Auburn get to be our highest-ranked SEC team? How on earth did this happen in Butch Thompson's second season, really for 1.5 seasons on the Plains?
It really is remarkable. I mean, you look at it this weekend, they beat Arkansas in a series. And like you said, you know, they're missing Casey Mize. They did have Keegan Thompson back. They've had him back for a couple of weeks. But, you know, this week Mize sat out with, you know, Butch said it's not a specific injury. It's just kind of some general wear and tear, and they're being cautious. But, you know, their offense just rolled this weekend. They really outslugged Arkansas, which has been pitching pretty well, but it was a little thin on the mound as well, frankly, just like Auburn. But, you know, the Tigers are able to go out there and outslug them. And, you know, you look at the team and it's not, you know, their offense is not particularly stacked with, you know, elite prospect types. But they just go out and they win baseball games. You know, they've beaten Florida, they've beaten South Carolina, they've beaten Arkansas all at home, and they just play really well there, and they're playing pretty well overall. Every time, you know, they get a test put in front of them, it seems like, you know, they really, they go out and they pass it. They're sitting at 12-6 in the league, and, you know, they're a game off Mississippi State for first place overall. You know, and the Bulldogs, they get them this weekend over in Starkville. But I mean, if you look at the top four teams in the SEC, it's not just Auburn that's a surprise. You got Mississippi State leading the league. You got Arkansas, Auburn, and Kentucky all a game back. And you know, Mississippi State made the NCAA tournament last year, won this league a year ago, but then they lost 10 guys to pro ball. They have an entirely new coaching staff. So, you know, we coming into this year, we thought they would be a good team, but, you know, I certainly didn't have them in first place in the league. And, you know, these other three teams, they all missed the NCAA tournament. Arkansas and Auburn were the last two teams in the conference a year ago. And now, you know, all three of them are, you know, they're in the mix for hosting spots, you know, potentially for national seeds, especially when you talk about Kentucky with its RPI of 5. But it's been a little... It's been a little strange in the SEC, but credit to Auburn, you know, for going out, continually winning these series, and that gets them up to 5th in the poll, which is their highest ranking since 2003.
Yeah, I think that's when Josh Donaldson was there. So that's a long time ago. It might even predate Josh Donaldson being there. The thing that kills me about this, Mike, is that Kentucky, first-year head coach, Nick Mangione. First-year head coach at Mississippi State in Andy Cannizzaro. Mm-hmm. Second-year head coach in Butch Thompson. I mean, all these guys were SEC assistants, so they knew the league, but they're all at new schools. I mean, like, Mangione was assistant at Mississippi State, right? I mean, yeah. Andy Cannizzaro was at LSU. Butch Thompson has been all over the SEC previously, but most recently was at Mississippi State before coming to Auburn. All these guys are taking over teams that are new to them, you know, don't even have their recruits. You're supposed to have time to, you know, get put in your culture, bring in your recruits, bring in your guys. All these guys are kind of like, eh, whatevs, we're going to win anyway. I mean, that's the most impressive part to me about all three of these schools that have, you know, Dave Van Horn is the old school guy who's been in the league for a while, but which of those three teams, Kentucky, Mississippi State, Auburn, has surprised you the most, and which one, I think I know the answer to which one has impressed you the most.
Yeah.
So which one surprised you the most, though?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, you mentioned the three coaches, the new coaches. I mean, that just goes to show you. I mean, sometimes, you know, you have younger coaches, energetic coaches. I mean, sometimes, you know, a change in energy, a change at the top, you know, maybe that can, you know, fire up a team a little bit. And, you know, obviously the talent that they had on their rosters coming in, the talent that they inherited was, you know,
yeah,
not too shabby either. So
that's a good point to reiterate.
Yeah,
they took over. They did not. None of these guys took over where the cupboard was bare.
Yeah, it's not like they were any of them were going into terrible situations. They were all pretty good situations. But yeah, as far as which team has surprised me the most, I mean, it's been Auburn because, like you said, I mean, there really wasn't a situation where we envisioned that Auburn would be vying for the top spot in the SEC coming into this year. I mean,
yeah, I mean,
it's turnover and
correct me if I'm wrong, guys. Wasn't Auburn just until recently like getting sued by its previous head coach, Sonny Galloway? I mean, that was an ugly ending.
So, yeah, I think the lawsuit is actually still pending.
Still pending. All right.
Well, you know, looking at the team this year, you know, certainly to me, looking at the roster and what they're bringing in, it looked more like a transitional year for them, kind of building the program back up. And certainly it's not that they aren't talented. It just seemed like they were building something versus being here and performing at the level they're performing at now. And I know Teddy was mentioning they outslugged Arkansas. Looking at the numbers, the way that they've been swinging the bats lately, it's pretty incredible. In their first 34 games of the year, they hit 10 home runs as a team. In the last 8 games, they've hit 11.
Wow.
So that says a lot about how they're swinging the bats right now. And they crushed Blaine Knight, a guy who's been really, really good for Arkansas this year in that Friday game. So that really stood out to me. You know, Auburn continues to surprise me. And, I mean, their resume is their resume. You look at what they've done through SEC play, they've been great. So, you know, certainly from that standpoint, you know, they deserve to be number 5 just with the way that they've played this year, especially in conference play. But the team that's impressed me the most, the team that I like the most, and the team that I was pushing to rank a little bit higher on the call but did not win last night is Kentucky. You look at what they did this past week, and, you know, really, you know, I would say they had the toughest week in terms of just the opponents they were facing because you play a midweek game against number 2 Louisville, and then you have the weekend series against LSU. You know, that's a tough, tough slate there. And they went 3-1 against those teams. They snapped a 6-game losing streak against Louisville. And then they took 2 of 3 against LSU. Not only took it, I mean, they blew them out twice in that series. So they continue to impress me. I mean, really, since, you know, a season-opening sweep against North Carolina, which, you know, is looking better and better as North Carolina continues to play well. And really, I mean, it's not like UNC blew out Kentucky in any of those games. 2 of those games were one-run games. But you look at what Kentucky has done since then, and it's really been nearly flawless, except for a series loss at Mississippi State. Again, they weren't swept. It's just a series loss. I mean, they've been rolling, you know, and they have the second best record in the SEC, their first place in the SEC East, and it's legitimate. I mean, they were a team that we had talked about, you know, as kind of, you know, maybe not a number 25 team, but a number, you know, 26, number 27, number 28, and kind of in that range, potentially, as a team that had potential. But obviously questions with a new coach taking over and all of that. But they've been great under Mangione. They're a talented team. They can hit. They've got some pitching. I really like them. And, you know, they're going to South Carolina this weekend against a team that just can't really close out games right now. It's South Carolina's been close, but they just for whatever reason, they just haven't been able to finish off these series.
I was going to ask you guys, I mean, like, which team are you most worried about in the SEC? I mean, South Carolina hasn't won a series, it feels like, and they haven't gotten on a winning streak in a while. They're still 23rd in the RPI. It feels like, you know, South Carolina, Vanderbilt, Ole Miss, all three of these teams that are 500 in the league. Ole Miss has the lowest current RPI, but, I mean, it still feels like it's a, you know, all three of those teams feel like they have a shot to be regional teams. They're one hot streak away, maybe, from being regional hosts. I don't know, though, Teddy, for me, like South Carolina, they still have to go on the road to LSU, Missouri. They're home against Kentucky this weekend, and they finish up with Georgia. It feels like South Carolina really, I guess, instead of even looking at the schedule, South Carolina just has to worry about playing better before they can really think about anything else. I mean, which of those teams, I guess, would you be most worried about between those 9-9 teams, Ole Miss, South CAC, and Ole Miss, I mean, Vanderbilt?
Yeah, I mean, the one that I'd be most concerned about is Mississippi. You know, they're sitting with an RPI of 40. That's the worst of any of these teams. You know, South Carolina's at 23, Vanderbilt's at 21. That's still very comfortable. You know, obviously, top 20 RPIs, top 25 RPIs don't get you into the tournament on your own, on their own. Just ask UNC. But they're a very strong starting point if you can just finish close to 500 in the league. Whereas Ole Miss is sitting at 40, which is kind of at the edge of what is okay for an SEC team, and they still have trips to Arkansas, to Florida, and to Auburn, and the home series is against A&M. So Ole Miss has a very tough slate here for a young team as they try and figure out a way to finish strong in the final month. They're going to have to do it on the road. And, you know, that's just not an easy position to be in. So they would be the one that I'd be most concerned about now. Obviously, South Carolina has trended in the wrong direction over the last month, but they were starting from a much stronger point than Ole Miss was. You know, so they still have a bit of this cushion that Ole Miss kind of is lacking right now.
And you just saw Texas A&M a little bit this weekend. Again, a team that's kind of trending back in the right direction, a team that's gotten back in the rankings. Last week was 23rd. This week moved up to number 19. You know, 10-8 in the league. They have a series win against LSU. They have a series win against Auburn. Feels like A&M is also trending, I guess, in the right direction. Teddy, what did you see this weekend that impressed you out of the Aggies?
Well, they just pitched really, really well all weekend, all week long, really. You know, that's kind of what this team is doing. And, you know, that's getting back to what we thought they were going to do coming into the year. They lost a lot of players off of last year's team offensively. And, you know, they started off the year actually swinging the bats pretty well. And their pitching was a little bit, you know, lagging. But they've gotten that fixed. Brigham Hill on Friday nights continues to be very difficult to beat. And they've moved Corbin Martin from the bullpen to the rotation. And that's really helped them out, with Hill and Martin going 1-2, and then Stephen Kolek as their number three starter. You know, they're very difficult to beat in weekend series. And Mitchell Kilkenny has left the rotation for the closing spot, and he's handled that really well. He has like six saves, and he's been closing for like 3 or 4 weeks is all. So they've you know, they've got this pitching strained out. Their offense is sputtering a little bit. They only scored 10 runs this week in 4 games. And part of that is that Tennessee can pitch as well, but they do kind of need the offense to step up a little bit more and support this pitching staff. But I think ultimately A&M is going to be a pitching and defense team. That's kind of what they're designed to be. And they're really hitting their stride on the mound now.
I mean, would they lose 2 All-Americans last year out of their lineup with Boomer White and Ryan Burke? They lost a lot of veteran guys off of that roster.
Not to mention Banks, you know, Nick Banks.
Yeah. Right, Nick Banks.
Team USA, 2-time veteran.
Right, even like off the bench, like they didn't even play Ronnie Gideon consistently last year. And then Ronnie Gideon showed up in the Pioneer League. I had to tell our guys on the pro side, hey, you know, like our writers are just who don't cover college baseball. Hey, Ronnie Gideon was not a full-time player in college. You know, he's got a lot of power, but don't go crazy on him in the Pioneer League. You know, I mean, they have a lot of pieces to replace in the lineup. So I guess that's probably why, I would imagine that's why their preseason schedule, their non-conference schedule was a bit on the soft side. The Bowling Greens, the UT Rio Grande Valleys, Brown, those kind of teams being on their schedule. That's why their RPI is in pretty bad shape. And it seems like that kind of bit them a little bit in opening weekend against Kentucky. I don't know if Rob Childress talked about that at all, but it feels like the more they play in the league, the better they're playing.
Yeah, I mean, they started off 0-5 in the SEC. They lost, they got swept by Kentucky at home, and then they lost the first two games of their series at Vanderbilt. Since then, they've really turned around. They're 10-3 in the league, and they've got some nice series wins. They went on the road and won at LSU. I mean, I think the team has kind of grown up here. They've made some important adjustments, like I mentioned, and their closing schedule is manageable. They go to Missouri this weekend. They go to Ole Miss, and they get Mississippi State and Arkansas at home. And, they play really well there at Olsen Field. And, they're going to be difficult to deal with down the stretch for these SEC West teams.
All right, well, I know we've talked a lot about the Southeastern Conference. I feel like the other league that is most compelling at the top is still the Big 12. I mean, we've talked about that a decent amount this year. We moved TCU back up our rankings to number 4 this week, basically kind of reflecting the fact that Clemson lost a series last weekend. They just lost it after we went out Monday. I guess I should touch on that Clemson lost to Florida State in that series. I did want to touch on the Florida State-Miami controversy a bit. A, because rivalries are fun. B, because those two schools really do not like each other, and it's like a cantankerous rivalry in a lot of sports, but especially feels like, obviously, football is a bigger rivalry because they've had national implications in football. But to my knowledge, I don't think Florida State and Miami ever played for a national championship in football. They did in baseball when they were not both ACC members. In 1999, Miami won its third championship, I believe it was. Yeah, I think that was their third title. Florida State, that's the closest Florida State ever has come to winning a championship in baseball. So that, they used to play six times a year. That is a heated rivalry. And both teams really needed a win. Correct me if I'm wrong, Teddy, but basically there was a lightning delay. And in a lightning delay, Miami's grounds crew is not allowed to go put the tarp, to pull the tarp. No one's allowed on the field because of the lightning. So while they weren't pulling tarp, there was a deluge, and the game got banged at that point. And neither team seemed happy about it, but Florida State especially did not seem happy about it. I got to imagine that it feels like that rule about the lightning and all that kind of stuff is in place in a lot of places, but it feels like the ACC does not have a uniform rule for how to treat postponements. We've had Boston College with two Sunday doubleheaders this year. Like this weekend, you have just the way the doubleheaders are scheduled in the ACC all seems like it lands on the host team. The league doesn't get very involved in it. I don't know if you see that changing based on what happened this weekend, because it seemed like Florida State and Miami were not in agreement on how that was settled.
Well, Jim Morris also was not happy with this. I want to make clear that Miami wanted to play this game as much as Florida State. They probably wanted to play this game even more because they really needed it. They're still under 500. They need as many wins as they can possibly obtain, and the only way to get those wins is to play them.
And Florida State has a nice RPI.
Well, they need any wins because they're under 500. But getting quality wins, they need to help their RPI too. And beating Florida State, if they could have, Florida State was winning in the third inning when it was called. But if they could have come back and done that, that would have been very, very significant for the Canes. And Jim Morris, after the game, I guess he said, once the lightning alarm goes off, you're not allowed to be on the field. The umpires are in charge. We had our players in rubber cleats, the non-starters, all day today to go out and cover the field. He wouldn't let them go out. Then he stopped Florida State from going out, too. We couldn't put the tarp out.
Right.
And as far as I know, there's no universal rule about this. I could be wrong on that, but I've seen this happen before. It happened when I was at South Carolina last year, and they were playing Florida, and their Sunday game got canceled because they weren't able to get a tarp on the field fast enough. And I think it probably happens even more often than we realize. It's just that, it doesn't end up costing games.
I think you're right.
And, it's unfortunate that, this happens. It obviously, this is all a liability issue. And You know, maybe the ACC could give more direction, or you know, maybe even the NCAA. I don't know, but it's really unfortunate in this case because these are two teams that maybe could find a spot on their schedule to make this up. You know, I haven't looked to see if they have mutual open dates, but it's not like they're that far away. You know, so it's unfortunate, but I also don't think, you know, neither team is happy about this.
Right.
And, you know, there's nothing nefarious going on here on either side.
Right. I think, you know, what the league could do is say, hey, come to Louisville a day early and play before the conference tournament, because that's, you know, that week of May, nobody's in class, but you would definitely impair those two teams' chances of winning the league tournament by making them play an extra game.
I mean, let's not forget that this is the league that would have let Miami take a home series or take a series that was going to be snowed out and was snowed out. They weren't allowed to move it to Miami because you know, they didn't want to have the appearance of you know, them buying a home series a couple years ago or whatever it was.
Right.
The ACC is, I don't see them doing anything to help out in this situation, but, you know, it just is unfortunate that
I know I've done this before.
Ends on that note.
Yeah, I know I've done this in past podcasts long ago, but it really is, I'm quoting Al Gore, but there is no controlling legal authority. It's the parody that people used to say about Al Gore. But the ACC has really no controlling legal authority that gives a darn about baseball. That's really where this comes from. And this, you know, I don't think you'd ever see it handled so haphazardly in the SEC. I do think it would happen in the Pac-12 if they had weather issues. But they, most of their league is in California and Arizona. So like, dude, what are you talking about? I mean, like, there's no, we don't have rain here. You know, like Kyle Glazer, our resident Southern California native who comes to the office today complaining about, what's the deal with the weather in the state? Why does it change so quickly? It's like, because it's not California. So, but Virginia is the linchpin for both these. Both Miami and Florida State have to play the Cavaliers the next couple weeks. And I just was looking up some notes on Virginia, I should say. Virginia is redamdiculous offensively.
Yeah.
This team's hitting .313 in the league in 21 games. How about they have 92 strikeouts as a team in 21 games? They're averaging like, it's a strikeout rate as a team of like 8%. Pavin Smith has 10 home runs, 6 strikeouts. Adam Haseley has 12 home runs, 15 strikeouts. Rami Koeman has more home runs than strikeouts. Ernie Clement has like no walks, no strikeouts, and he's hitting like a soft .330. But the point is, this team is such an anomaly, Mike, offensively.
Yeah.
They don't strike out. And in college baseball, where other teams play crap defense at times, they are going to keep putting pressure on you and pressuring you. I know Virginia's pitching is not vintage Virginia. I really think that team is extremely dangerous. I would not want to fail. I don't think they're great, but I think they're really great at this one thing, and that is going to be hard for some teams to handle.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can make the case that offensively, I mean, they're certainly one of, if not the best offensive club in the Brian O'Connor era. I mean,
I think you're right. Hey, they are. The 2015 team was awfully good.
Yeah, the Virginia's for Sluggers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 2014, I guess it was a 14 team that didn't win it, was actually the better offensive team.
Yeah, but the 2015 team that did win it, the guys that are on the team now were freshmen that year. And we saw the, you know, what that experience has done for them. I mean, you look up and down that lineup. I mean, it's scary. Really, what jumps out to me, and we've talked about him a lot of late, but Adam Haseley, just the progression that he's made this year. And I know talking to Coach O'Connor before the season began, he was talking about how the ball was coming off his bat a little bit with a little bit more authority in the fall, and he thought he was going to hit more home runs this year. I don't think he would have predicted 12 at this point, the team lead over Pavin Smith at this point, but
I respect his authority. No question.
Yeah, no, he, you know, the thing with him is, you know, I was wondering where they were going to make up some of the power that they lost from losing Matt Dice.
Right.
And here you have Adam Haseley all of a sudden as a slugger in the middle of the order, hitting 12 home runs and, you know, still pitching great on the weekends as well. So, and I like, you know, I know the pitching situation, especially early in the year, did not look very promising for Virginia, but I think they've figured it out. I think they've found a good formula on the weekends now with Derek Casey and Noah Murdock. I've been really impressed with the way Noah Murdock has kind of grown up pretty quickly in these last couple of starts for Virginia. You know, another scoreless outing this weekend against Notre Dame. So I think that's been a really big change for them, you know, being able to figure out that weekend rotation. And, you know, they do have some experience in the back end of that bullpen with Alec Bettinger, who's having a really nice year. He's been up and down in his career, but he has the stuff to be a decent bullpen option. And then Tommy Doyle with 11 saves this year. He's done a nice job for them. You know, 23 strikeouts to 4 walks out of the bullpen. So
I got a sideways on this ACC thing, but I'm obviously obsessed with Virginia's lack of strikeouts. Wrote about it a little bit. I'm a little obsessed with it, and just they are a common opponent for Virginia and for Florida State and Miami going forward. So that's going to be an interesting one. Teddy, I did want to get back. I mean, I know you're seeing some American Conference this week, or you've already seen some this weekend, and you're going to see some Big 12 action in your Texas trip. Let's steer in that direction. First off, the American Conference is, you know, we don't have, last year we made fun of how much our colleague Vince Lara loved the American Conference the last 2 years, really. This is a pretty messed up league. I mean, I don't think we really know what's going on in this league, do we? I mean, do we have any idea predicting this league? And when's the last, I can't remember seeing a team do what Tulane has done. From being the bottom of the barrel at the start of the year.
Utah.
That's true. Utah did do this last year to an extent, but wasn't a first-year coach. Another first-year coach, another first-year SEC assistant, and Travis Jewett going to Tulane. And Teddy, just how did he turn around Tulane so fast? This team is still under 500. They're the only under 500 team in the league, but 8-4, they lead the league. What'd you see out of the green wave this weekend?
Yeah, I mean, Tulane started the year 3-12, and I think a lot of people were looking around, like, what is going on? And, you know, Tulane won the conference a year ago, the regular season, and then they brought a large portion of that team back, and obviously David Pierce left to take the Texas job, but most of those players were back. Rogers and Alamez, two very high draft picks, were gone, but a significant portion was back, and they started so poorly, but they've turned it completely around, and they're sitting at 20-21 now. They're 8-4 in the league. Houston became the first team to beat them in a series in the league. And it was a very tight series. Tulane won on Friday night. Houston had to come back on Saturday to win it, and then they kind of blew them out on Sunday. Tulane's pitching depth is not the greatest. But it's a really powerful offense. They score a lot of runs, and really that's been the key, is that they've gotten the pitching going a little bit, you know, just enough to give these hitters a chance. And, you know, they go through the lineup, and it's a really deep lineup. And, you know, they've really just stuck with the whole program. Coach Jewett told me that they're embracing the word stick-to-itiveness. They're not giving up, they're persevering through the slow start, and you know, they've really got a roll in here. And if they do get to regionals, they're sitting on an RPI of 81. But you know, if they keep winning games, they could maybe get there, or maybe if they win the conference tournament, if they get into the postseason, I don't think teams are going to be thrilled to see Tulane show up, in their regional.
I mean, I think JP France has played for like 3 head coaches there. He's been around a while in their weekend rotation.
I mean, any of the seniors, I think, are on their third head coach, because David Pierce was only there for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, there's some veteran names there, names that even I recognize, even old man John recognizes on Tulane. But so they haven't had the easiest road to contending. Neither has Houston. I mean, I think all of us guys would have imagined that if Seth Romero, if you took him out of the equation for Houston, I know that happened last year. I know he was suspended last year. But as well as he was pitching as well and throwing as well. You know, every draft call I made the first couple months of the year was, when we talk about college pitchers, it's like, hey, don't forget Seth Romero. He's really dealing. Houston wins that series. Like you talked about, Houston moves up in our rankings to number 20. I mean, Houston feel like they should be the favorite in this league. Do you guys both think they are? I mean, Teddy, you saw him, but Mike, obviously, I want you guys to, we're not going to embrace debate here, but do you guys both think that Houston's the team to beat going forward in the league?
I mean, I think at this point with, they're sitting in first place at 8-4, but there are five teams within a game of each other. It's kind of anyone's league a little bit, but at the same time, I think you look at Houston and you look at the amount of talent they have there. It's a strong rotation, even without Romero. Trent Cumbie, John Kane, they've been very good for them this year. And, they have offensive pieces. Connor Juan hit three home runs on Sunday. Corey Jolks, Jake Schiner, Joe Davis is a little banged up, but if they can get him healthy, I mean, it's a strong overall team. That has good experience, and I think they should be the favorite. But I also wouldn't be stunned if, Tulane or South Florida or Central Florida or even UConn, which has as good starting pitching as anyone in the league, if one of them is able to finish strong here. It's going to be close. There are only four conference series left. It's going to be close.
I mean, Mike, now I'm going to sound like Vince, but all these teams are pretty good. I mean, really, yeah. All these teams, like Central Florida and South Florida, both have a case for being ranked. I mean, they don't. I think it's better that we don't have them ranked. I mean, like, South Florida's schedule's been pretty soft, but yet they beat Central Florida when they played head-to-head.
Yeah.
UConn was ranked at one point. They've kind of backslid a little bit since then. But I think we like their rotation, like Teddy was saying. I feel like they're four or five. This feels like it should be a 4-5 bid league. I don't think it's going to necessarily be, but four bids? That's not out of the realm of possibility, is it?
I mean, looking at the RPIs right now, I mean, you have three in the 20s, Houston at 24, South Florida at 20, UCF at 25, and then you have UConn that's kind of, at 43, has a chance if they continue to play well and they finish well. And then, obviously, Tulane kind of has the outside chance. They're at 81 right now in RPI, but if they win the league or if they continue on this trend, I don't know if they'll have – I mean, they are playing – they're playing LSU this week. They still have series against UCF, another series against Houston. So they do have some opportunities to build up their RPI. We'll see how much they actually can do it. But yeah, for me, I mean, I tweeted about it with a Sesame Street gif of just looking really confused. I don't know what to make of the American right now. I really don't. Because obviously in the preseason, we liked ECU as the favorite, and they've been the worst team in the American in terms of record, although they've been very banged up, which has certainly been a part of it. They have Evan Krasinski back now, and he pitched really, really well this weekend, and they finally won a series and finally won some games in American play this weekend. But
that's good.
They have an uphill climb, six games back. But yeah, it's very, very, very tightly bunched at this point. I do think outside of ECU to start the year, Houston was my other team that I really liked in the conference. They were my Omaha sleeper, yours as well, John.
Yes,
so,
well, that was mostly based off Seth Romero.
Yeah, so. Well, I still think even without Seth Romero, as Teddy said, I do like their rotation. I mean, obviously, I don't think they don't have anyone with quite the stuff that he has, but they still have college performers and guys who have done well for them. So
that lineup that Teddy described, that's a good lineup. That's a good college lineup. That's a physical, experienced college lineup that has some power, that didn't have to wait for the last eight games to hit some home runs. Who were you describing earlier?
Auburn.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is...
It's a legit... They're probably the most, in my opinion, probably the most talented team of these teams that we're talking about, just from a pure talent standpoint.
And you guys will do another 64-team projection coming up, because, why not? We'll give you guys more work to do. and the last weeks, we had four American Conference teams in. I did want to touch a little bit out west, guys, if you don't mind. Zigzagging a bit. I know I'm skipping right over the Big 12, but we should wrap up. But there was a little bit more interesting, more news, I guess, I thought, out west. Teddy, you moved Long Beach State into your eight for Omaha this week. Feels like Long Beach State deserves that. Fullerton loses a series to Cal Poly. Long Beach State beats Irvine. Long Beach State is really outside of that one, just like what weekend against Arizona State. Feels like Long Beach State has been so consistent this year. This is not a star-laden Long Beach State team like some of the ones of old, but maybe that's for the better, because it feels like Torrey Buckley just has a very complete ball club out there. If you have them as an 8 for Omaha, are they going to be a top 8 national seed? Is that in the cards for Long Beach State?
Well, I moved it back If you go back and look at my initial eight for Omaha that I did, after immediately following last season, they're in there. And, I backed off that a little bit in the preseason. We installed Fullerton as the Big West favorite. I felt pretty good about that with their pitching staff. But, they're a little banged up, and Beach is playing incredibly well right now. Now, can Beach be a national seed? I don't know. The RPI is at 18, and they don't have a ton of opportunities to, really improve that. It's still three games at Fullerton, which will help. But Fullerton and Beach are the only two teams in the Big West in the top 100. So,
which is really amazing. Tough. I mean, it's just amazing that league's...
And Cal Poly, just beat Fullerton this weekend, but they're still sitting at like 129. So it's going to be a little harder for Beach to get that RPI just a little bit higher. But if they are, they could be. I mean, if they go out and they win the Big West, they have a lot of road wins, which the committee likes, and they still have a series at Minnesota, which is another chance to improve the RPI and pick up some more road wins. That's obviously not going to be an easy trip for the Dirtbags, but they're a comfortable host, I think, at Blair Field, which is, undergone some nice renovations recently, and they don't lose there. Maybe they can be a national seed, but I think they're just in good shape, and it's a good experienced lineup to go with a strong pitching staff, and that really tends to play well in the NCAA tournament.
I'm just stunned that they've played. I'm going to guess there's not a lot of other teams that are in this mix to be a regional host at the very least that have played 21 road games. And they still have two road series left, like you said, Minnesota, and technically they're on the road at Fullerton, I suppose. But this is, it blows my mind there are only two teams from this league that are in the top 100 RPI-wise. Not just top 50, but top 100. And they've got, I'm selling them short. You guys correct me if I'm wrong. It feels like I'm selling them a little bit short on star power. I mean, David Benuelos is going to be a pretty good draft pick behind the plate. I'm not sure if he'll go out higher than a Connor Wong, for example, or Whitley, I believe, is the catcher's name, and Oral Roberts. I'm blank on his name. They're not a whole lot of really high picks this year in the college draft class, but there are a lot of guys who could go third or fourth round. But like Darren McCaughan was on the Team USA last year. He's pretty consistent.
He's had back-to-back complete games.
I was about to say, he's kicking it old school with the three CGs.
Yeah.
So they do have, Dave Smith's been outstanding. They do have some star power in terms of their college. And to me, Benuelos and McCaughan, those are kind of college stars. But it feels like Fullerton has a little bit more shiny names, more star names. Long Beach State just has been more consistent. And they haven't been to Omaha since 1998. It's the last time the Beach... And they never went with Tulowitzki, never went with Longoria, Bobby Crosby. All these stars they produced to the big leagues. David Espinoza, or I suppose Danny. I think Danny's the one who's in the big leagues. I get them mixed up. Forgive me, I'm old and addled. I get my Espinoza switch-hitting middle infielders mixed up. But they haven't been in a long time. So it'll be neat if the Beach can get back to Omaha because it has been a while. Who are the other West hosts? Outside of Oregon State, which is dominating the Pac-12, did the West take a hit in terms of host this weekend because Arizona got swept? Arizona is number two in the RPI among all these West Coast teams. I have to imagine Fullerton's a hosting consideration again, but outside of Fullerton, Long Beach State, and Oregon State guys, I got to feel like Arizona took a hit as a regional host this weekend, getting swept, and they're now 500 in the league.
The Wildcats are still in better shape than the Titans, I would say.
Okay.
The Titans dropped all the way to 32. Arizona's still staying on a top eight, they're number eight in RPI. So that's still probably going to get it done. They need to improve on that 9-9 record in the Pac-12, I would think. But their RPI still gives them a chance to make up that ground.
See, what I was setting up for, here's what I was setting up for, though, is that next weekend they're at Stanford. That feels like that could be a regional. That feels like that could be a regional hosting showdown between Arizona and Stanford. Stanford. Stanford swept Oregon this weekend. Oregon had been really pitching pretty well and playing well. I'm not sure that it came out of nowhere for Stanford, but all year we kind of talked about how Stanford's played a tough schedule, good losses, They didn't have great wins. Now, I guess, if you're comparing them to Arizona, if they win this series, if they could win this series, they also won a head-to-head. Hey, they both got swept by Oregon State. No big deal there.
Yeah.
Stanford won this series against Utah. Feels like Stanford's starting to hit a little bit, Mike. And, I mean, geez, I guess Stanford will go as far as Colton Hawk's arm will take them because they do seem to rely very heavily on Colton Hawk out of their bullpen, and they will use him as often as they can possibly use him, it seems.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I think this is the kind of performance that we were waiting for from Stanford, right. And one of the reasons that we dropped them out the week before is just they hadn't really, looking at their schedule, they hadn't really had that marquee series win, and they've just been kind of inconsistent this year for the most part. I know we kind of compared them a little bit to South Carolina, what South Carolina has done this year in the SEC, whereas, you know, they have the talent, but you're just waiting for the results. And I think this weekend was a really nice showing for them to go to Oregon and sweep the Ducks there, a team that's been playing very well and, like you said, been pitching very, very well. To be able to do that, just to beat David Peterson alone is an achievement. So that was certainly impressive, and, you know, we'll see, you know, if they can carry that against Arizona. They do obviously have the benefit of playing at home, where they're 14-7 this year. So we'll see. You know, Arizona, it was kind of interesting to see their offense sputtering a little bit this weekend playing at home against Utah. You know, they were coming into it, I believe they were the number one ranked offense. They're certainly in the top three coming in, and they just really couldn't put runs on the board this weekend, at least not to the level that they had been. And I know we were talking about it last night. I mean, they aren't a pitching first team. They're an offense first kind of team, so they need to score in order to get it done. So it'll be interesting to see. I think you're right that, you know, it could be a regional showdown. I mean, Arizona start off the year so hot, you know, I think they're kind of trending down a little bit of late, but we'll see. This is a chance for them to right the ship, and it's a chance for Stanford to keep going in the direction that they're going in.
Well, I think at the start of the year, if you told me, hey, Stanford's going to have this kind of year, they're going to be in position to host a regional, I would have said, oh, well, that makes sense. They've got Tristan Beck, and they have kind of the senior Brett Hanowich back in the rotation, had a great fall, these great reports about Brett Hanowich, and Colton Hawk at the back of the bullpen. And Hawk has held up his end, and to their credit, he threw 2 2/3 on Friday, didn't pitch the rest of the weekend, because some scouts have been complaining to me about how heavily he's been used. But Beck hasn't pitched all year. Hanowich hasn't been a factor. Doesn't throw enough strikes, hasn't been a factor. They're basically doing this with Chris Castellanos has been outstanding for them and pretty consistent. Chris Bubich is not really like a classic Friday guy, but he's been competitive for them on weekends. And their bullpen in front of Hawk, Matheson and Thorne, those guys were outstanding this weekend. And yeah, this is really more of they're kind of like Arizona. They're an offense first team, even though they don't have the gaudy numbers. You know, in my mind, Quinn Brody's, I don't know if I'd call him a breakout guy out west this year, but he was a area code games guy and a big deal at high school. He's kind of put some things together this year. Mikey DeKroger, the DeKrogers are to Stanford baseball what the Plumleys were to Duke basketball. There's this the third DeKroger. There've been a lot of DeKrogers. They basically had a DeKroger every year since 2010, I believe it was. I think it was the oldest DeKroger was a 2009 draft.
Yeah.
So 2010 freshman year. That's 7 straight years of DeKrogers.
I prefer DeHarris Teeter to Kroger, but that's just me.
It is ripe with grocery store puns that are there to be made, and leave it to Mike to make them. But now they're starting to get Daniel Bax into the mix offensively. Nico Horner, their shortstop, did a nice job. Tommy Edman was kind of a stalwart for them for 3 years in their lineup. Sometimes it's a hard position to replace. Horner has replaced it. So I think it's going to be a very interesting matchup between those two teams because they are, I think, both offensively oriented. And whichever team, you know, it feels like Arizona tries to find those two or three guys they can ride on a weekend, and they're looking for starting pitchers to take them deep into games. Stanford's looking for 5 innings, and they want to go to the bullpen. And that it's an interesting contrast, and I'm really looking forward to that series in the Pac-12. And I do think it's going to be – and the winner of that series is much better positioned to be a regional host. I'm curious what you guys think of UCLA and Cal. There's Cal's second in the league and UCLA's third, but their RPIs are both kind of iffy. I mean, Cal, basically, Teddy, you and I talked about this last week. They're 1-9 against the top 50 on midweeks. Cal just gets hammered with some regularity. I mean, they're just, you know, it feels like this is just not a team that is very deep on the mound. But considering how high our expectations were for Cal last year and how spectacularly they fell short of them, they swept USC this weekend. You know, they've won some series. They swept Arizona State before that and Wazoo. You know, are either of these teams regional threats? I mean, Cal's got to go on the road to UW and Oregon State back-to-back. It feels like if Cal's going to be a regional team, it would behoove them to go 3-3 in these next 2 weeks. That means winning a series on the road against one of those two Pac-10 North old-school teams. I don't think that's very likely. Which of these teams, Cal or UCLA, do you think has a shot to maybe make a run this and be a regional team toward the end of the year?
So I will definitely take UCLA. I am impressed by what Cal has done. It's an incredibly young team that Dave Esker has there this year because, again, they were expected to be much better than they were last year. They got really banged up, and they couldn't overcome some of those injuries, and then they lost a lot of their older players, and they're playing a ton of freshmen. But it goes beyond just UW and Oregon State, those two road trips. Then they have Stanford at home, TCU at home, and they finish at Arizona. So if they win these games, they're going to get in the tournament, and they're going to get in with a really nice RPI. But that is, I think, the toughest 5 weeks you'll see left on anyone's schedule.
Yeah.
Even if you shorten it to 4 weeks, because most teams, you know, will finish with their conference tournament, like that is a very, very tough slate. So UCLA, having already played Oregon State and taking their requisite two losses, it's sitting in conference play, in a much better position. They've got Cal Poly this weekend, and then they go back into conference play to finish at USC, at Wazoo, home to Utah, at Oregon. So it's a lot on the road, but it's more manageable.
It's doable. It's not easy, but RPI, it's doable.
Yeah, it's a little less RPI favorable, but they're already up to 57. They can just push it up a little bit further and maintain a second or third place in the Pac-12. You know, they might be in good enough shape. They're sitting at 500 overall, though, so they do need to get wins, and they need some decent wins, but I think they're in better shape than Cal is.
I think you're right. Here's what impressed me the most about UCLA. They're both very young teams. UCLA's offense really trending in the right direction. If you just look at what they've done in the conference, they're hitting 289, 380, 416 in the league. It's nearly an 800 OPS in league play for UCLA, whereas overall for the season, their offensive numbers look pretty pedestrian. But in the conference, it's not like they're playing totally different guys. Michael Toglia, you know, very toolsy, athletic, young outfielder, really starting to come on. Ryan Creedler, who they really believe in, really coming on. Chase Stumpf, you know, a guy who they thought would come right in and be a factor offensively, has been more of that in the conference than he was before in the non-conference. The other X factor to me is, I mean, I know Fridays are supposed to be tough in the Pac-12, but Griffin Canning hasn't been great in league play. He's got a race close to 4 in league play. He's better than that. So I have to think that UCLA, I think UCLA is going to be kind of, it's not quite the same. They kind of remind me of West Coast Virginia, that they're getting better as the year goes on. They're probably going to be a 3 seed somewhere, like at Fullerton or at Long Beach. That's going to be tough for those Big West teams, Mike, to have UCLA, if they can make it into regionals as a 3 seed.
Yeah,
they're going to be lurking down there, because especially if they can win one of the games, like with Cieja, who's been outstanding as their Saturday guy.
Yeah.
They could start him in the 2-3 game, maybe win that game, and then you got to face Griffin Canning on Saturday in that regional. Good luck with all that. I wouldn't want to do that. They're going to be tough if they can get in.
Yeah, well, I mean, UCLA has been kind of a bubble team for us the last couple weeks in the field of 64. I mean, it's a team that we're keeping an eye on because they've been trending up of late. Obviously, they're still just 500 right now. They need to win more games. But
Utah's in the same boat. I mean, Utah's 500 and has a higher RPI.
Yeah.
And they go to UCLA later. That could be
like a
winner, you know, a Thunderdome, two teams under, one team leads. That's an old Mad Max reference. You guys probably don't get that reference.
I do not, but Utah certainly had an impressive weekend this past weekend, sweeping Arizona for the second straight year. But, you know, going back to UCLA, yeah, I mean, I've been impressed with Michael Toglia. You mentioned how he's been heating up. And
he looks the part.
Is a guy, yeah, he's a guy that they had high expectations for, and he got off to a slow start, but he's been hitting really well in conference play lately. Has been really important for them offensively. And, you know, the thing with them, you know, comparing them to another team, I know you're comparing them a little bit to Virginia, kind of reminds me of the trajectory they're on is kind of Tulane-ish that starting off non-conference play, 8-10 in non-conference play, and now they're kind of heating up a little bit. Obviously, Tulane's in better shape just because they're tied for first right now in the American, and, you know, I can't see UCLA catching Oregon State or anyone really catching Oregon State at this point, but at the same time, I was impressed with the way that they played Oregon State this weekend. I mean, they could have won that series.
Right.
You know, the Friday game, they forced extras with that two-run shot there in the ninth inning.
And Hudson Belinsky with a nice little report on that one. If you didn't see it at baseballamerica.com, Hudson was out there and wrote about Luke Heimlich and Griffin Canning matching up in a, what sounded like a kind of a classic Pac-12 Friday night pitchers matchup.
Yeah, and, you know, Canning's been pitching really well of late, too. I mean, that's his second straight outing. Before that, it was a shutout with 12 strikeouts, and that was his third 12-strikeout performance of the year. So he's heating up and pitching well for them right now, and he is a dangerous weapon for them. And, you know, they almost won on Sunday, too. They were leading 1-0 going into the eighth inning before Oregon State, you know, was able to score those two runs. Oregon State's just had that magic this year. They've just been able to find offense when they need it late in games. But
now, also the scouts I've talked to doing West draft coverage, everyone's so impressed with Oregon State. I mean, I consistently get, they don't really have any holes. I mean, I get that consistently. Like if Nick Madrigal, you know, Nick Madrigal's not a big physical guy. So there are times where he might make a throw that's not a great throw. They'll just switch him and Caden Grenier. And who has Caden Grenier just like hanging out at second base so you can just move him to shortstop and play him?
Yeah.
I mean, the depth and athleticism of Oregon State's roster is different, it sounds like, than their competitors.
They're really good. They're a really special team. I came away very impressed when I saw them, and they did play Grenier and Madrigal interchangeably. And now they have Rasmussen back. He didn't pitch this weekend, but I know he warmed up.
In the pens.
So, you know, you get him back. You know, whether they start him or just throw him in relief, that it's still a weapon. I mean, he could be a power arm in the back end of a bullpen for you, and, you know, that only makes you stronger.
It's kind of like a late-season trade, what they just did. They just picked up an ace, at the very least, a factor.
Yeah.
And maybe they could use him as a closer. Oh, well, they probably don't because Mulholland's been awesome back there. Maybe they could use him on Fridays. Oh, no, Heimlich's been great there. maybe even Saturdays, though, Jake Thompson's really, really good. They really, you know, they don't need him. But now they have him, and like when I was watching Saturday, oh, here's Grant Gambrell, first-team high school All-American last year who's, you know, been very effective in middle relief for them. So they have talent in the freshman class. They have talent, a lot of talent in the sophomore class. They got talent in the junior class.
They're so good.
They really don't have a
They're
hole.
Just really
They're
good.
Number one. It's like an easy number one. There's like them.
Yeah.
And like
Louisville's the closest.
Right. But, I mean, I think there's a decent gap after those two teams. No offense to North Carolina, who's sitting three, or TCU at four. But for me, guys, it feels like Oregon State's on its own level. Louisville's maybe a little closer maybe to Oregon State than it is to three. But I don't even know if I believe that, you know. I mean, like, I don't know, Teddy, if that makes sense as a question. I'm giving Mike a moment to ponder. But, I mean, like, well, I'm putting you on the spot.
People ask me all the time, you know, who's the best – team that you've seen, and I have not seen Oregon State yet, but I've seen those other three teams that we're talking about there, UNC, Louisville, and TCU, and generally I say Louisville and TCU, and then I often throw North Carolina into the mix, and I see it as a top four, a strong, strong top four. You know, there's a difference between Oregon State and those other teams, certainly, but when you factor in, you know, the experience that TCU has, they're much older than these other teams we're talking about. You know, I think that definitely plays. And, you know, when you look at Louisville with Brendan McKay and, you know, just how good he is and how impactful he is on both sides of the ball, you know, he's probably the best player on any of these teams. No offense to Nick Madrigal.
I think it's still him, as much as I love Madrigal. Madrigal would have to go, like, throw 60 innings, too, to...
Yeah.
I mean, maybe right. not that many because his defense is so good at short and second. But yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, so I think those four teams are all right there, you know, with each other. With you know, Oregon State is a clear cut one, but I don't see a massive gap between any of the teams in the top four.
I'll just throw in one more thing as we were on the Pac-12 to wrap up. Just keep an eye on Utah because yeah. Utah does have they still have that rotation, which LaPiana and Rose back from last year. I love Jason Rose. I want to make sure I get my roses, keep my roses in the front there, big guy, to use a Bull Durhamism. Now Riley Addison's on the weekend now. I mean, I think he's a little overheated as a draft prospect. He was throwing 96, 97 last year. I see some bloggers who've written about him. Oh, my God, Utah has this big power arm. Yeah, they had him last year. I'm pretty sure he was eligible last year as a freshman coming off his LDS mission. They have some offensive firepower, too. They could probably use someone to go with Kiersey and Dallas Carroll, who be a little more consistent for them offensively, but I think we found out last year Utah's pretty gritty. Gritty, I wouldn't even say gritty and gutty, both.
Wow, the double G.
I did. I went double G'd it.
Yeah.
I did.
So. Well, the thing about Utah, too, is looking at their schedule down the stretch. I mean, sweeping Arizona, this was huge for them RPI-wise, obviously. Yes. Bumped them up 22 points to 35. And really, the rest of the way, I mean, playing Washington State's their next series, that's a series that they should win. UC Riverside, another series they should win. Southern California might be a little more challenging, but again, you think...
Series they should win.
Toughest series, and then they also have Arizona State finishing the year. Again, a series they should win, given how Arizona State has played this year. Their toughest series is UCLA, which, as we said, could be, you know, kind of... It certainly would have some postseason implications to it, more than likely, but other than that, it's very manageable for the Utes at this point, and I feel good about their chances, especially where their RPI is right now. You know, doing what they did this weekend really put them in a good position going forward.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried about Oregon. You know, they have to shake that off. They still have to play Oregon State, which I guess they're probably the one team that's not going to say we're gonna lose that series. But we're gonna maybe try to take one game. I mean, you know, the Civil War is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Between those teams.
That's an RPI benefit just playing it though.
Yeah, they exactly.
On that field and it helps.
But they don't want to say that so.
They can't talk about that, but like the reality is that their RPI is going to benefit no matter what they do, and they get midweeks against Oregon State too. I think they have five games at Oregon State left.
Teddy, you guys will have to write about the Big Ten because I didn't ask you about the Big Ten, but we did bring Maryland in. We still have Michigan ranked. We could go on, but we probably shouldn't. It's been a long podcast. That's what happens when I get involved. I did make it through the whole thing.
You did.
I'm excited about that.
It's been a long time since
I'm excited about that. I ate lunch before this podcast. That's a big reason why.
I'm excited about eating lunch after this podcast because the one Pop-Tart isn't going to hold me over for the entire day, as good as it was.
Teddy, have some Texas.
I will say Texas A&M Corpus Christi coach Scott Malone tweeted earlier that his lunch, he tweeted a picture of it. It was a Pop-Tart, brown sugar Pop-Tart, Mike. I don't know where you rank those, in a Mountain Dew. So you're a good company with Scott Malone there.
Brown sugar is when I'm feeling a little classier. When I want to, you know, class up my breakfast, I'll go with brown sugar. But otherwise, I like to go with a little more sugary stuff.
Than brown sugar? More sugary than brown sugar?
Yes.
How come you taste so good?
Like a chocolate fudge or the red velvet has been a go-to of late. This morning I had vanilla latte and it was wonderful. I hope they don't discontinue that brand. They are discontinuing apparently the orange crush Pop-Tart, which is good because that thing is terrible. It is bad. I tried it just to say I tried it, but I'll tell you what, it was not good. So that's my
I'll tell you what steal. Is good. Louisville Slugger and their power in numbers and their sponsorship of our college baseball coverage and this podcast. And before it goes any further off the rails, I'm sorry, Mike. I'm not.
It's okay.
Usually I'm the one who does that. So I appreciate that someone else has that power. So Teddy, eat some brisket for me in Texas, please. Small bits of it if you must, but some brisket for me would be appreciated. So for Teddy in Texas, follow him at Ted Cahill on Twitter. Is it at Ted or Teddy?
At Ted.
It's at Ted Cahill. I like the Ted Talks, which I believe starts now as we get done with this, that you'll be chatting. And he's at, what is your at, Mike?
At M. Lanana.
It is just M. Lanana.
It's simple. Well, it's not simple because Lanana is really tricky to spell, but you'll figure it out.
For these guys, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you on the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.
After the end of a good fight, You deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.